is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're seeing more momentum towards repeal of the Affordable Care Act. The House has followed the Senate's lead and passed its own resolution, leading to dismantling of the health law. And a number of provisions they're putting forward are eliminating everything from protections for those with pre-existing conditions, protections for women receiving contraception coverage, and also protections from lifetime caps on insurance payouts.
Well, while they are still in the process of producing the replacement plan in Congress, Mark, there's been really quite a bit of effort to initiate repeal of the ACA, or at least many aspects of it, which are quite popular with consumers.
But still a lot of unanswered questions from the healthcare industry as we look forward.
And that's something our guest today has unique insight into, Mark. Dr. Richard Gilfillan is CEO of one of the nation's largest not-for-profit health systems, Trinity Health, a $16 billion system spanning 22 states, includes more than 88 hospitals and health facilities that really cover the full continuum of care.
He served as the nation's first director for the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Innovation in the Obama administration. And before that, he was the top executive at Geisinger Health System, a contained system in Pennsylvania that aligns providers, payers, and hospitals to control cost and focus on patient outcomes.
Dr. Gilfillan is also the chair of the Healthcare Transformation Task Force. That's a consortium of stakeholders across the country at the highest levels of the health industry, all of whom have recalibrated their business models in recent years to align with the directives of the ACA, to make healthcare accessible to all Americans, and also to incentivize ways for the industry to trim costs and improve care. They have some pretty strong ideas about how the Trump administration should proceed with health reform. We hope to hear some of that.
Lori Robertson always stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Richard Gilfillan in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Showdown in the Senate in the confirmation hearings for Georgia Congressman Tom Price to become Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. All Democrats serving on the Finance Committee boycotted the meeting that would have sealed his nomination. Senate rules require at least one member of the minority party to participate in the confirmation vote. Democrats refused to attend, demanding the chance to ask more questions of Price, who had already taken significant grilling over his investment portfolio, which included a number of pharmaceutical companies who allegedly benefited from his past legislative actions. A day later, the majority Republicans on the Finance Committee overrode the Democratic boycott, confirming him anyway. Meanwhile, a delay of another kind, President Trump's Muslim travel ban from seven Arab nations, is impacting health care already. 25% of the nation's physicians hail from other countries, and a number have been held up already in the wake of the ban. According to the health publication Stat, the Middle East is a significant pipeline for medical professionals across many health industry disciplines. The 90-day ban is the first wave, but there are concerns among hospital and other health administrators that the announced extreme vetting of all attempting to come in from certain Muslim countries could prove an additional barrier. The president has also discussed changes to the H-1B visa program, which facilitates the hiring of foreign workers to fill important health industry vacancies. President Trump also met with leaders from the pharmaceutical industry, an industry he has publicly vowed to crack down on for exorbitant drug pricing. The president urged them to not only lower their prices, but do more to manufacture drugs in the U.S. Trump also vowed he would streamline the Food and Drug Administration, making it easier for drugs to gain approval and access to the marketplace. The meeting led to significant spikes upward in some pharmaceutical company stock prices in its aftermath. Trump also sent a warning to foreign countries that benefit from drug manufacturing business that they will, quote, have to pay their fair share, Trump saying he was putting an end to what he called global freeloading. And if you don't use it, you could lose it, according to a recent study conducted at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. Engaging in brain games for older adults actually does delay the onset of mental decline. The study looked at 70-year-olds who had not begun to exhibit mental decline, which is often a precursor to dementia. Those who engaged in gameplay saw a 22% reduction in the onset of decline. But other activities had significant benefits as well. Those who made crafts saw a 30% reduction in mental decline, and there was a 23% benefit for those who engaged regularly in social activities. The study's authors say learning a complex new task like quilting or photography showed a significant benefit for older participants. So, want to keep your wits about you? Get creative, stay busy, and get in the game. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Richard Gilfillan, CEO of Trinity Health, one of the nation's largest not-for-profit health systems, serving communities in 22 states and across multiple hospital and care facilities. Dr. Gilfillan served as the first director of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Center to develop innovative models for improving health, improving care, and reducing cost. Prior to that, Dr. Gilfillan served as Chief Executive Officer of Geisinger Health Plan and Executive Vice President of Geisinger Health System. He also serves as Chair of the Healthcare Transformation Task Force and has twice topped Modern Healthcare's list of most influential physician executives. Dr. Gilfillan received his undergraduate medical degrees from Georgetown University and an MBA from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Gilfillan, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah. My God, the world has changed. February 2011, we had you back, and so much has happened. At that time, you were the first director for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, overseeing the emergence of a new care delivery model aimed at advancing value-driven and patient-centered care in America. Healthcare system, and now you run one of the largest not-for-profit health systems, Trinity Health, an almost $16 billion health system which serves patients across 22 states. You are, as we all are, welcoming the new Trump administration. Many are expecting significant changes to health policy. And what do you think the changes will be, both the government and the private sector, with a new administration? And what are the challenges for an organization like yourself to address what looks like a pretty dramatic shift in policy?
Well, thanks, Mark, and I certainly don't have the definitive answer for you this morning.
Okay.
And I know I'm not alone in that regard. But I think, first, it's important to step back and realize that the conditions that we're trying to address with improving our healthcare system continue to be ensuring that people have access to care and making sure that we have a delivery system that is poised and capable of delivering efficient, high-quality care. I think those two realities will continue to drive efforts in Washington to improve healthcare. We always knew that there would be a second act in transforming our healthcare system, and now that act is being written, and the dynamics are different this time around, but it will address the same two issues, I think. I am hopeful that we'll find a way to continue to have access for people to real coverage and have them be covered with great insurance plans. And I am hopeful that we will continue on the work that has been done across the entire country at transforming the way we deliver care. I think we've made great progress. And I believe that that issue of transforming the delivery system has always been bipartisan. And that gives me comfort as someone who's working in a large health system like ours, that the course we've been moving on towards changing our system into a people-centered health system focused on delivering better health, better care, and lower costs for as many people as possible will continue to be the right strategy.
Well, Dr. Gilfillan, in addition to your enormous leadership role with Trinity Health, you wear another very important hat at this moment in time as the chair of the Healthcare Transformation Task Force. For our listeners, that's a coalition of more than 40 stakeholders, really across the top tier of providers, payers, patient groups, and the healthcare industry, all of whom I think we can say have been very focused on the importance of shifting to this value-based system of care delivery. So can you talk a little bit about the goals goals of the healthcare transformation workforce, maybe a little bit about who some of the key players are, but really what are the driving initiatives of the task force at this time?
Well, the task force came together because many of us in the private sector felt that it would be advantageous to develop a center of gravity and momentum within the private sector to encourage and move forward on changing our delivery system. And so individuals from and leaders of other health systems, private insurers, employer groups, and patient advocacy groups came together to build this task force. The first goal we established was to have 75% of our respective business for the payers and the insurers and the employers operating through alternative payment models. That is, payment models that reward providing the triple aim for the people we serve. So that was the first goal. We thought we could do that by being a leader and by being out front and establishing a goal, by finding new ways of delivering care and paying for care, sharing those across the industry. And finally, be an effective voice encouraging public, that is government programs, state and national programs, to align with these private sector initiatives. Because the path to really achieving a sustainable value-based payment system is by aligning private sector and public sector efforts.
Your group just wrote a letter to the incoming Trump administration as well as leading members of Congress to approach such reforms cautiously. Just thinking about what you had said earlier about sort of the dynamic being different and a hope for bipartisanship. We've had a couple of interesting folks on. Mike Leavitt was on recently, whose hope was that people should go slow if they want to go fast. The real problem with the first round of the Affordable Care Act was it didn't have bipartisan support. It wasn't a settled matter. Is your group worried about that it may be deja vu all over again? This type of reform may not have the type of bipartisan support it needs to have to give the healthcare industry some surety that this is not going to find itself turned over again in the future.
Well, I think the lack of bipartisan support is primarily with regard to the approach to ensuring coverage for people. Actually, over the last 7 years, It's safe to say that the notion that people deserve coverage, I think, has actually become
settled.
Exactly. Okay. I think that's true. The degree to which and under what kind of market mechanisms or government mechanisms is to be played out yet. But I believe that we have seen in our country that it makes sense for people with pre-existing conditions to have access. It makes sense for young people up to age 26 to have access to coverage through their parents' plans. It's advantageous for individuals who are entrepreneurs and want to not be locked into their current job because of health insurance. It makes sense to have an individual market that works and is viable and then go out and start their business. So exact mechanisms, clearly there'll be debate and disagreement. On the other hand, with regard to delivery system reform, I believe there has been bipartisan support. The most obvious evidence of that, of course, is MACRA. It's a bipartisan bill that encouraged the movement towards alternative payment models. Every time I went to the Hill and talked with people on both sides of the aisle, there was support for this notion of delivery system transformation. And so from our standpoint as a health system, we want our people to have access to coverage. We also want to continue down this path, and our members of our task force want to continue down this path to changing the way we deliver care and changing the way we pay for care. That's why we wrote the letter that we wrote to the administration. It was specifically asking them to give signs of their continued support for that approach. And I think if you read between the lines of some of the things you see out there today, I think we're actually hearing that there is support for delivery system transformation.
Well, Dr. Gilfillan, you've touched on three things we think about all the time. And it's great to hear your perspective that maybe this is now hardwired into the consciousness of the American people, that there's the need and the right for coverage and the need and the right to access. And then we always say that big question is, okay, now access to what, right? You, at some point in your early training, had some time as a family practitioner in a community health center model of care, spent considerable time at Geisinger. So you so clearly understand the importance of policies and practices that support population health management, and you built a unique system at Geisinger where every element is in sync regarding both the cost of care and the outcomes of care. For our listeners, talk about that care model a little bit and why it drives the results that you think it can drive for us.
I think that the most critical element of these models that we're trying to build is that the providers of care are conscious of the need for and accountable for delivering coordination in the care that people receive. In some ways, that's the most real absence of service that we feel in healthcare. If you talk to someone who's taking care of their parent or a child who had complicated medical problems and said to them, gee, it's a complex system out there. Who coordinates your care to make sure that each one knows what's going on with you? Many of these are specialists, of course, and they tend to look at their area of interest. The cardiology looks at the heart, and the pulmonologist looks at the lungs. And who coordinates across all those different sites of care? And the answer today is the patient or the family coordinates that care. We've all had the experience of scratching our heads and saying, really? These people aren't talking to each other? So the hallmark of accountable care in my mind is coordinating care and keeping track of a patient as they move across the system. Imagine a system where there is a coordinator, where as soon as you touch that system of care, you can rest assured that the care providers will understand you in all your dimensions, and someone will be looking out for you, making sure that that movement from a hospital to a nursing home to home is actually a smooth movement. That, to me, is probably the hallmark of the new systems of care that we're trying to build. And while Geisinger had elements of that, the truth was we didn't have that for every patient in every care episode. So it's moving towards a system where that is the reality that we're all working towards.
We're speaking today with Dr. Richard Gilfillan, CEO of Trinity Health, one of the nation's largest not-for-profit health systems. Dr. Gilfillan served as the first director of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And I'd really like to sort of pull the thread and go back to that time that you were leading the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovations. And, you know, there's general confusion in the public's mind about lots of things that have happened under the Affordable Care Act and certainly the innovations that were launched. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the initiatives and the impact that they're having today.
Yeah, if we go back to those early days of there was already talk about the idea of accountable care organizations, groups of physicians and hospitals that came together to build the capability to coordinate care, as I just described. Also, primary care and medical homes and building care coordination into primary care, paying for episodes of care differently from just paying for the hospital stay, but paying for 90 days, for example, for all services. We needed to test those models out because they hadn't been very well tried up to that point. And so the work that we did early on and in conjunction with the Shared Savings ACO program from the Center for Medicare, we constructed a series of models to test how well those different payment models would support delivery models that coordinated care better and produced better outcomes. And then, of course, it expanded to find ways to work with states. That was the state innovation model. And then we also are interested in encouraging other kinds of innovation, encouraging people to try different care models. And so that was the origin of the innovation grants programs that we did. That was all about incenting the development of new kinds of care models, all focused on delivering better health, better care, and lower costs. So it was really about redefining the way we deliver care.
Dr. Gilfillan, I'd like to take a look for a moment at what you're trying to achieve now at Trinity Health, which I believe is the second largest not-for-profit health system in the country. You're obviously a staunch proponent of coordination of care, the accountable care organizations. Tell us a little bit about your experience as you're finding in such a large health system trying to implement these changes. And what are you learning that you think might help inform Congress and the administration as you grapple with those transitions in such a large health system?
Certainly, Margaret. Let me just also go back and answer a question I didn't answer before, which was what kind of folks are on the task force? Many of these organizations are pursuing work like we are. People like the Advocate Health System, Ascension, which of course is the largest not-for-profit healthcare organization, Beth Israel Deaconess Care in Boston, Catholic Health Initiatives, another large system, Greenville Health System, a very progressive system in South Carolina. So all these are folks that have done great work, and of course Montefiore and partners in Boston. Payers, we've had Aetna, we've had Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, Massachusetts Blue Cross Blue Shield, that were leaders in alternative payment models, and Healthcare Services Corporation of Chicago. We've had the Pacific Business Group of Health on Health, which of course have been leaders nationally for a long time, and the National Partnership for Women and Families, and Community Catalyst. So a very extensive set of folks that are working together, all of whom have that commitment to deliver 75% of their care or their services under these alternative payment models. And we've been at this now for about 3 years. Our goal is that 75% by 2020. That's our specific goal in our strategic plan that our board has approved. We have built accountable care organizations in each of our markets. We've built a large episode-based payment model working closely with CMS, Medicare, on about $500 million worth of services that are paid for under that episode-based approach. And we've had many of our primary care sites operating as medical homes within the context of our ACOs. And we're actively redefining the way we deliver care in our hospitals, in our networks of outpatient caregivers, and even in our community. We're in our community health and wellness group. We're working closely to address and improve the underlying determinants of health. We capture all this in our strategic objective, which is to build a people-centered health system together that addresses acute care, population health management, and community health and wellness. So we've invested about $140 million over the last 4 years, and what we have learned is people love this work. We have about 120,000 employees now across our system, and they are excited about being able to do this work, particularly the care coordination approach. It's hard work to transform the way you operate. And, you know, people say, well, you're building the airplane and flying it. Well, you know, we're flying a plane, in effect, we're delivering care that people need when they're sickest. You know, we touch 6 million people a year, and we provide probably about 1.5% of all the hospital care in America. Then we say, oh, we'd like you to coordinate care and build these new care capabilities, right? So we're rebuilding the airplane as we're flying it. Well, how about you change the rules of gravity? So we're changing the payment rules in addition to rebuilding. And it, frankly, it takes longer than I had hoped when I came here. I think that's the lesson nationally. But I believe we're clearly making progress. Payers are learning. CMS is learning, because when they've changed the payment mechanisms, that's something they need to adjust on constantly. And I think CMS is doing an excellent job of learning as they go.
You're a CEO of a very large health system. And I wonder what your advice is, both to other leaders and to your staff, because we've been flying that plane, changing the engine. We may land the plane now. You know, that's enormous, a psychological issue. We only have 1,100 employees, but we hear from our own folks all the time about what's going to happen and how do you keep people focused? And there's a real anxiety. People are grappling with the change. You know, the ACA is still the straw that stirs the drink, and it's going to be altered. We're going to see some form of replacement. As a CEO, what are you telling your own people about how to stay focused?
Well, we believe that the fundamental dynamics are not different. We are strong advocates for ensuring that people have coverage. And so we will continue to be strong advocates in every forum we can find to ensure people have coverage. Because healthcare is increasing in cost, there's no way healthcare is not going to continue to be driven from a cost standpoint because of all the advances that are being made. Therefore, everything we can do to make the system more efficient, more effective, and to deliver better outcomes is going to be valued. Learning how to deliver more value is a no-regret strategy regardless of what the world looks like in the future. And so we are focused, we stay focused on that. The reality is there's plenty of care to be delivered. The need for care is increasing. Healthcare, by all projections, is going to be a growth industry. And so that's the reality. If we focus on advocating for access, delivering great care for the people we're serving, and finding ways to deliver more value, those will be positive in any future we can imagine.
We're speaking today with Dr. Richard Gilfillan, CEO of Trinity Health and Chair of the Healthcare Transformation Task Force. You can learn more about his work by going to trinity-health.org/Richard-J-Gilfillan-MD, and you can follow the work of the Healthcare Transformation Task Force by going to hcttf.org. Dr. Gilfillan, thank you so much for your work and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks very much, Margaret and Mark. I've enjoyed it.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In a press conference about a week before he was sworn in as president, Donald Trump touched on the Affordable Care Act, claiming that some states had seen health insurance premiums on the ACA exchanges increase by 100%. Only Arizona has an average increase that high, and 84% of those with marketplace coverage in 2016 received tax credits to purchase insurance. Premiums on the ACA exchanges for individuals who buy their own insurance have jumped up substantially from 2016 to 2017, an average 25% increase among the 38 healthcare.gov states. The increase the year before was only 7.2% on average. Trump cherry-picks the high end of the increases. Arizona had a 116% average increase. Indiana, at the other end of the extreme, had an average 3% decrease. At least one county had a nearly 100% increase. In Medina County, Texas, the average increase was 99%. Texas overall, however, had an 18% average increase. The vast majority of Americans who buy coverage through the exchanges get tax credits, which shelter them from these premium increases based on income. The HHS report says 84% of the 10.4 million Americans with marketplace coverage in the first half of 2016 received tax credits. Trump said at the news conference, quote, "We're going to have a health care that is far less expensive and far better." He promised to provide a replacement plan shortly after the Senate confirms his choice for Secretary of Health and Human Services. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For all the people in the world without limbs, acquiring prosthetics can be costly and out of reach. It's especially challenging to make prosthetics for children, since they are in constant state of growth. Rochester Institute of Technology scientist Dr. John Shule stumbled upon a clever and affordable solution, provided online open source templates to anyone anywhere in the world who has access to a 3D printer, and provide prosthetic hands for next to nothing.
I've made this Google Maps mashup. If you have a 3D printer and you'd like to help, put yourself on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put yourself on this map.
He founded the Enable Network, which has massed thousands of volunteer makers in upwards of 40 countries around the world, providing cheap but functional prosthetics for children in need.
I think we're currently pushing 5,800 identified members in our Google Plus community, and we have followings in the thousands more. We know that we've delivered about 800 hands devices, and we suspect that a comparable number have been downloaded by people we can't track because we put all of our design on the internet.
The simple limb designs have become more sophisticated as recipients of the prosthetic devices provide feedback for designers to make more efficient devices.
We're still working on opposable thumbs. These things grip or ungrip. That's all they do. So they're much less functional than a biological hand, and they're also less functional than a fancy myoelectric hand. But for kids, it's huge because because those expensive devices are typically out of reach for children who would outgrow them. So it doesn't make sense for them to get a $5,000 or $10,000 hand. And, you know, our hands don't even pretend to look like regular hands. They look like superhero Iron Man hands. And for that very reason, they're very popular with kids.
Enable, a global collaborative network of open source designs, linking to makers with 3D printers to provide low-cost prosthetic limbs to children and adults around the world. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.